So we've been asked today to offer merit to Tenzin Dadwal, a Tibetan refugee in his early 20s in India who's just been diagnosed with TB as a family friend of Sister Nekamma. So during this rains retreat I've been trying to teach and also trying to practice these teachings on metta, which are so important as part of the Buddha's teachings. And remember the very beautiful Dhammapada verses, I can't quote them off the top of my head, but something like, happily one lives, one who has without hatred, one living among those with hatred, one lives happily. And this is the reality of our lives and our situation in the world, that there is always a tremendous amount of hatred in the world, and that the main or the dominant ideology seems to be that if one can crush one's enemies, then this is somehow a victory, and that by defeating and crushing others, one can eliminate problems somehow. And of course this is completely against the Buddha's teachings. So remember that the goal of Buddhist practice is not to be in some kind of world where no one's ever going to hate each other, because this doesn't happen. This is not the reality. The reality is that loving kindness is relatively rare, or a pure kind of loving kindness, a deep kind of loving kindness is fairly rare, and that there's a like kind of islands in the midst of a lot of hatred and aggression in the world. And so If we make it a condition that we're only going to have metta when other people around us also have metta, then this condition is never going to be fulfilled. If we say I'm going to overcome my anger when conditions around allow me to, when I'm not being provoked to anger anymore, then that's when I'll work on it, and I'm not going to recognize it or acknowledge it. I'm going to justify it to myself and to others, until that point that I've reached a point where there's in fact no anger or things provocative of anger around me. And then when those surrounding things that make me angry and make me annoyed, when those things aren't there anymore, when I've managed to crush my enemies, when I've managed to remove the people from the monastery who I don't like, when I manage to surround myself only with people who I have a personal affection for, and when I don't encounter anybody who I have a personal dislike for, and then I'll address my anger and try to overcome it. Of course, this is nothing but complete and utter foolishness, and this is not the Buddha's teachings. So when we see people who are practicing in this way and who seem to want to try to solve their anger by removing people around them who provoke anger, then you realize, well, this poor person has come to try to practice Buddhism but hasn't learnt the first lesson of Buddhism, that we need to be looking inside our own heart to overcome our own anger within our own heart. So this is why the Buddha's teachings are so challenging, and why this mirror of the Buddha's teachings is so quite disturbing. You know, it's like when you get up first thing in the morning, as I've quoted often, my favourite blues song, I woke up in the morning, got out of bed, I went to the bathroom, I looked in the mirror, oh man, I'm so ugly. One of the most beautiful blues songs ever written by a black Negro who was jailed for murder and was pardoned by the governor of the state in the late 50s because of his skill at singing blues. So this is the reality, isn't it? Like the mirror, when we look in it, is very revealing, you know, it's very stark. You know, we can see all our pimples, all our wrinkles, all our blemishes. We can't hide anything. And so a simile that Ajahn Brahm would give would be that, you know, when we try to control external situations to take away those things that make us angry, then this is like a woman who is very vain about her appearance and looks into the mirror and sees the wrinkles and sees all the lines and the pimples and things, and to solve this problem gets out a makeup kit and starts putting makeup on the mirror and blotting out the pimples on the mirror and erasing the lines on the mirror. And of course, it's very easy to laugh, isn't it? But then we kind of look at ourselves and think, oh, how many times have I done that? How many times have I been putting makeup on the mirror? So this is the kind of the instinctual reaction. We want to put makeup on the mirror. And we want to change things around us, change things external to us, without actually changing the problem. It's looking inside. And this is something which continues to happen. It's not something which you can just overcome once. And then you think, oh, I understand that now. This is like sort of kindergarten Buddhism, that, oh yeah, okay, I've got this anger, I've seen it in myself at that particular occasion, and I was able to overcome it, therefore I understand and I know what this problem is. It's not what the mind is like. It's just that voice in you which is telling you, oh, I have overcome this problem. This is the voice of Mara. So as soon as you hear voices telling you, I understand the Dhamma, then you know that this is the voice of Mara speaking. Because unless you're an anagami, then you haven't understood the nature of greed and hatred. Only the anagami has understood those things. So unless we're at that stage, we haven't really overcome these. We've got a very partial kind of understanding, which is sometimes in our mind in certain circumstances, but at which many other times, in many other circumstances, is simply not there. And so all of these thoughts and things which come up in the mind to distress and hassle the mind, and these disturbances and defilements which create delusion. And so as long as we have these feelings of anger and hatred, then these will delude the mind and they will not allow us to see reality as it really is. So as long as these things are in our mind, we won't see the truth. And so we should be very cautious and very humble about giving any opinions on what we think the truth might be. And the more that our mind is filled with hatred, that the less likely we are to be able to see the truth. The more we're going to spin it, the more we're going to distort things to our own perspective. So if we want to see the truth, this is what we have to do. We have to be able to overcome these kinds of aversion and negativity towards things, and be able to try and if we can't completely see things from I don't think there is such a thing as a completely neutral or objective point of view, but at least we can get it to a stage where the distortions and the biases are manageable, at least where they're within reasonable limits. And as long as they're not within reasonable limits, then we're just going to be like a sheer prey to delusion and fantasy, making up things that are just manifestly untrue, and then when it's proven that they're manifestly untrue, then refusing to admit it and to just keep on believing what we always believed. This is the nature of delusion. This is the nature of the defilements. We see these things happening in ourselves and we know this is defilement. This is Mara. It's not anything else. It's not the mirror's fault. It's not the mirror produces the pimple on my face. It's the defilements, it's the toxins, all the problems in my body that's produced the pimples. In the same way, when we look into the mind, we realize it's not anybody else who's produced these defilements in my mind. It's me who's produced these defilements. That's all. Any other explanation is completely unnecessary. And any other solution is completely unnecessary. We just need to overcome our defilements. And when we can overcome the defilements, then we can start to deal with these things in the appropriate way. Until we've done that, then there's no point. Until you've got like a reasonable level of equanimity and judgment about things, then there's no real point in trying to talk about what's true or what's false or what's right or what's wrong. You just can't do it. Your mind's just too confused, too overcome with defilements. And so there's really not much point in trying to talk about these things. You just need to overcome the defilements first, at least to a reasonable degree, like a normal sort of level of equanimity. And so this is like the practice of metta is not something we should be at all complacent about. It's not something which, we can sort of have and develop some samadhi or metta or something like that and then think that we've kind of mastered it. It's not the case at all. If somebody has, like if you've truly mastered metta, like somebody who's really mastered it has, you know, can enter into jhana based on metta regularly, like every day for a good period of time, and then keep that hindrance of ill will suppressed for long periods of time, then that's wonderful. You know, that's an amazing thing to be able to do. But it's very rare to find. I think there are people who are like that, but it's very rare to find them. More normally, what we experience is that, you know, we have feelings of anger and ill will towards people, and they will come according to as we use what we call ayoniso manasikara. That means reflecting or thinking about the bad or negative side of things, the things that give rise to ill will. In Pali, it's called the papigha nimitta. Remember, we were talking about the Mahanidana Sutta the other week, or last weekend, we talked about the papigha sampasa, the resistance contact, the hitting contact. And this is another, the same word, papigha, in a different context. Here it means like ill will. But it's a similar kind of idea, that there's like a hitting or a violence involved in it. And so when they have the papigha nimitta is that sign of things, that aspect of things which arouses anger. And so as long as we're paying attention to this papigha nimitta, then anger arises. It doesn't arise for any other cause. Anger does not arise from any other cause. It only arises from the cause of looking at the papigha nimitta, those things, that aspect of things that is productive of anger. And so this is a question. The point of this is that the giving rise to anger is a question of our own attention, how we use our mind. It's not something which is given to us in our environment. Our environment presents itself to us, and we choose how to respond to that. We choose how to pay attention to that. We choose how to see it. We choose what is going to be our connection or our relationship with that environment. And if we choose, through our own mindlessness and the influence of our own defilements, to look at the papigha nimitta, look at those things that are going to be arousing anger in us, then we are choosing our own suffering. We are choosing our own dukkha. We are choosing our own anger. And of course, we're choosing our own anger, but we're projecting it on the papigha nimitta. We're saying it's that thing outside. That sight, that sound, that smell, that taste, that touch, that is the thing, that idea, that thought, that memory, that is the thing that's making me angry. But it's not that thing, it's the way that we're looking at that thing, it's how we're responding to that thing. This is what's giving rise to the anger. And so this is why Buddha's teaching is something which is very demanding, it's very uncompromising. It doesn't allow us kind of wiggle room, it doesn't allow us excuses. And this, the Buddha was uncompromisingly emphatic on this. Even if bandits were to seize you and cut off your limbs with a two-handed saw, anyone who nursed a single thought of hatred on that account would not be doing my instruction, not be following my instruction. So then when we're confronted with situations which are, well, usually a lot less troublesome than having your limbs cut off with a two-handled saw, then we give rise to not just one thought of hatred, but to thousands of thoughts of hatred. And every one of those moments when we're thinking those thoughts, we're not doing the Buddha's instruction. We're not a son or a daughter of the Buddha at that time. We're somebody who is spitting in the face of the Buddha. We're somebody who is throwing into the garbage can the whole Dhamma which the Buddha has bequeathed to us. This is what we are when we follow the way of hatred and anger. It's something that reminds me of one of my supporters in Thailand, and she became very enthusiastic and very diligent at one stage in her practice and was wearing white and keeping 8 precepts, and her husband didn't like it at all. And so he eventually got her shrine from her shrine room, meditation room in the house, and then threw it into the garbage, because he was so overwhelmed with hatred and anger towards the Dhamma. Well, this is really what we're doing. Every time that we make a thought of anger and ill will in our mind and cherish that and nourish that thought and believe in it and justify it to ourselves and make ourselves the view that somehow we're right. Every time we do this, then we are taking the Buddha image, the shrine, or taking the Buddha himself and throwing him into the garbage and treating him like crap. This is that state of mind, and so that's why this state of mind only leads to heat and burning and torment in the body and the mind. So this is why it's so important for us to really be able to recognize these forces within ourselves. It's so important to be able to look into your mind and recognize, oh, this is what I'm doing. Until you can do that, you haven't started practicing. Until you can do that, then you're a sham, you're a fake. If you come here and pretend to be practicing and you haven't, and you're still blaming and criticizing everybody else for your problems. Or you say, I can only practice as long as everybody else is being nice to me. As soon as somebody else does something that I don't like, then I can't practice anymore. You know, this is a complete waste of time. So this is why that the Buddha's teaching on loving kindness is not, oh, when everybody's nice to me and does what I want, and I'm surrounded only by people who I like, and who I would choose to be around, and who do what I think to be the right thing and the nice thing, then I'll have metta. This is not the Buddha's teaching. The Buddha's teaching is, even though one is surrounded by hatred and anger and enmity, then one has no hatred, no anger, no enmity in one's own heart. That's the Buddha's teaching. So of course this is difficult, and probably none of us are able to do this all the time. You know, we try, sometimes we do it, sometimes we don't. And, you know, we don't expect each other to be able to do it all the time. There's no expectation that everybody who comes here is perfect or is free of anger or ill will or anything like these kinds of things. This is not, we don't expect that. But we do expect that people are willing to reflect and to be able to recognize defilements in their heart and to be able to do something to overcome it. This is a basic expectation in the monastery, that we should be able to reflect on our own defilements, to realize this is defilement, recognize defilement as defilement, and to strive to overcome it, and not to project it outside, blame others, and to think that you can overcome your own defilements by getting rid of people that you don't like or situations that you don't like. This is not the Buddha's teaching. So when we're trying to do this practice of metta, loving kindness, then when we first start to do it, usually or almost inevitably there will be like a coarseness to it and a fragility to it, so that we can, you know, we'll develop metta, maybe kind of quite strong metta. You can have like very overwhelming or overpowering emotions or emotional responses to things. And one's mind can be filled with rapture and joy and bliss. With this kind of sense of love and so on. And if you meditate in the right way and practice in the right way, then it's not that difficult to kind of rouse up these kinds of feelings. If you have that sincere devotion to the Buddha, to the Dhamma, to the Sangha, and if with that kind of sense of sincere devotion and joy in your heart, and you give yourself and throw yourself to that practice, it's not that difficult to arouse the kinds of feelings of rapture and so on, and they're very beautiful, very, very kind of overwhelming at that time. But of course it doesn't last, does it? And we can give rise to those feelings maybe through doing our chanting or through doing some simple meditation or something, but they come and then they go, they like pass through us. And of course it's very beautiful, it's very pleasant to have these kinds of emotions like washing through us like a wave. But it doesn't accomplish all that much. It gives us like a few moments or minutes of pleasure and freedom from the kind of the grosser forms of hindrances, but it doesn't go all that deep. So if we want to try to overcome these things in a much more meaningful way, this is where we have to develop the loving kindness meditation. I don't know really any other way of doing this except by doing meditation very deeply. When a mind is small, then things will upset us very easily. So again, this is how we test our mind. We say to ourselves, am I getting upset because of small things? And if they're things that are manifestly trivial and they're making us upset, well, obviously we have to reflect, well, that means my mind is small. If small things are making me upset, that's because my mind is small. People whose mind is big, they don't get upset by small things. And I think anybody would agree who spent time with any great meditation teachers, that They don't get worried and upset and concerned about trivial little things that are going on all the time. They've just seen it all. They've seen it so many times. And all of these kinds of things, they just let, you know, they just let them go. They don't concern themselves with these kinds of things. It's because their mind's big. And there's very beautiful similes given in the suttas for this. And the Buddha said, I think it was the Buddha talking to Rahula, like, make your mind like the sky. Maybe a series of similes, make your mind like the great earth. Like, you know, people can come along and crap on it and piss on it and dump rubbish on it and so on. But the great earth doesn't get upset because of that, doesn't get worried because of that. The same thing with the ocean. You make your mind like the ocean, make your heart like the ocean. And if someone throws some rubbish into the ocean, then the ocean's not going to get worried about that. And make your mind like the sky. When your mind is like the sky, then you can throw rubbish into the sky. It doesn't worry it. It doesn't concern the sky. The sky just drops the rubbish out. So this is what we have to try to do, make our minds like the sky, so that when people try to throw rubbish into it, it's just like throwing rubbish at the sky. What do you do? What does the sky do about it? It just drops it. It doesn't hold on to it. So somebody whose mind is developed, then all of these trivial little things that bother us in our daily life, then they're just like somebody who's throwing rubbish at the sky. And just like the sky would hardly even bother to notice it. It wouldn't even be worth the sky's while to even deign to concern themselves with something so stupid and so trivial. Just let it go, let it come, let it go. And it's like, so what? So this is why we see that those people who have developed these things, and not just the Buddha, but also great other spiritual teachers like Jesus or other people who have similarly developed metta to a very high degree, that they're not going around teaching these kinds of things. They're not going around concerning themselves with these kinds of trivialities. And they're not kind of forming factions and making violence and groups and opposing and all of these kinds of things. But they're people who will keep their eye on like a something, I don't know what, difficult to say the right word without being metaphysically refuted by it, but keep your eye on something beyond or something transcendent. It's like keep your eye on a bigger picture. Also keep your eye on something that's more important. And so these kinds of things are seen for what they are. They're seen to be very small and very trivial. So if we want to be able to do this, then we need to take that little bit of metta that we have in our daily life, that we have in those experiences in our lives, and to really be able to develop it very strongly and very powerfully, to be able to develop very continuously. So when I say to develop it strongly and powerfully, like, it's not necessarily, doesn't mean something that's extreme. It's something that's very moderate, something that's very subtle. And so, like, the true metta at a very deep level is not a kind of sort of gushing emotionalism. It's not like the kind of rush around and hug everybody and all of these kinds of things. And this is a kind of expressions or shows of loving kindness. It's quite a coarse level, but the loving kindness, which is very subtle, which is very deep, is very, very, it's hard to see. It's actually very close to equanimity. Like metta, which is very deep, it's quite different from equanimity, but it's also very close. And it has like a sense of regard and a sense of care, which is like sustained or which is long-lasting. So whereas the more kind of intense emotions tend to last for a very short time, then the deep emotions, the subtle emotions, then they will be more stable, they'll last for a much longer period of time. And so, of course, this is one of the reasons why we use metta for developing samadhi, because we want to develop a stable state of mind, and one which is very even, a very even mind. And as long as our emotions are wrapped up in these very kind of coarse, you know, anger or these kinds of things, and of course we're, you know, as the Buddha would say, far from samadhi, ara samadhi himha, far away from samadhi. So samadhi is based on subtle and pure states of mind that are very, very soft. They're based on states of mind which are very true. And samadhi always has a degree of, a strong degree of equanimity. It's not like only of course in fourth jhana is the equanimity fully purified, but it's there right from the beginning, even a long way before we can even think about jhanas. We have to have a lot of equanimity, otherwise we're just reacting and overreacting to things. So this is very crucially important, that the metta that we want to develop for samadhi has to be very, very subtle and very soft. And it manifests itself as not as like a personal liking or disliking or attachment to different people, but it manifests as a evenness or an even-handedness in how we deal with and relate to different people. And so even though we might be in a world where we are beset with kind of personal agendas and hatreds and personal likes and dislikes and so on, and of course people always wanting to try to project those things onto you. And of course this happens to me as an abbot very commonly. Everyone wants to try to project their agendas on me and to try to use me to fulfill their own agenda. And I try to do my best to stay out of that kind of thing and just stick to, well, what's the Dhamma and what's the Vinaya? And to try to do that as best as I can. I'm not saying I succeed all the time, but this is what I try to do. And so, you know, people when they see this and they see that, well, that Bhante's not taking my side in a dispute, they think that therefore I must be angry with them or I must dislike them or oppose them or something like that. Well, that's not the point. That's completely misunderstanding what's going on. The point is that I don't, on principle, take sides in personal disputes. So if I don't take your side in a dispute, that tells you nothing about what I actually think about it. That only tells you that I don't take sides in personal disputes. So of course everyone who thinks that I'm not taking their side automatically projects on me that I'm taking the other person's side. And of course the funny thing is, if you talk to the other person, they're likely to say, I'm not taking their side, I'm taking the other person's side. And so on and so forth. And so you can't really escape from these kinds of things. So this is why that metta needs to have a strong amount of equanimity. You can't have that strong equanimity, then metta will always be fragile, always be coming and going. It'll come in, fill your mind, oh wonderful, sadhu, overflowing with joy and love and everything, one moment, and then the next moment be filled with vengeance and bitterness and hatred. And this is the way of the world. It's the way of the world to oscillate and vacillate between these two things, back and forth, back and forth. It's not the way of the Dhamma. So the way of the Dhamma, we need to come closer to the middle. Closer to the middle, we stay on that side of non-hatred, we stay on that side of love, but we bring that side of love closer to equanimity. And so this is why we use this scheme of the four people in metta that I've been teaching. And we use for oneself, one loved one, a neutral one and a disliked one. We use this group of four people because we're moving towards a sense of equanimity. We're moving towards a sense where our love is not bound up with a sense of personal attachment. And so people get afraid of this and they think, well, if that's the case, then I can't love my family anymore. I can't love my mum and dad. I can't love my children. This, of course, this is a misunderstanding. That's not the case. Not that you don't love them, but it's just you love everybody else the same amount. I guess there's really two problems with that view. One problem with the view is that the theoretical problem, which is what I just said, that you know, if one whose love is perfected, it's not that they don't love their family and so on, it's just they love everyone else just as well. So that's one problem. The second problem is the practical problem, which is that, practically speaking, it very rarely happens. It's not that most people develop metta and are really able to develop even love for all beings. It's like an ideal, which we should aspire to. But practically speaking, for most of us, it still remains the case that, you know, we mainly love our family and those close to us. But we start to, even if we can't complete that process, at least we can start to extend that sense of love away from those immediately around us and those who, you know, our personal friends and those we personally like and those kinds of things, and start to break down those barriers and extend it out as much as we can. So at least we understand, even if we can't do it perfectly, at least we understand that this is what, where we're going, this is what we want to do. We know what direction we're heading in. So that process, as we go on that process, and as we're developing metta to like the higher levels and higher stages of metta practice, then as that goes further, then the equanimity gets stronger in that. And the sense of sukha, the sense of joy, becomes very, very subtle, so subtle that it's almost, we almost can't, don't know that it's there, it's almost disappeared. And you can almost not tell the difference between that subtle happiness and the state of equanimity. So this is the reason why at the end of every metta practice, at the end of every time when you're doing metta, you need to just let the feeling of metta go, let the words of metta go. And we almost objectify that feeling of metta, step back from it and watch it fade away. So what people usually want to do is if they have a feeling, a happy feeling in their meditation, they want to continue it. They get attached to it and they want to feel like that all the time. And so you want to sort of finish your meditation and get up and go around and do all, you know, your sweeping or whatever you're doing, keeping that feeling of metta going. Of course, it doesn't work like that. The feeling is impermanent and it's only there because of causes and conditions. So what you do is you let the feeling go and you watch it, and you watch that feeling change into equanimity. You see that, oh, okay, and then you can know the difference between those things very, very clearly. And you can see that feeling, that metta, also is impermanent. So this is how you're using your metta, your samatha practice, also to give rise to vipassana. That mind state that I had, that is impermanent. That's also ending. That doesn't last forever. And we watch it finish and we watch it go to equanimity. And in that state of equanimity has like a different character to the character of the bliss and the happiness of metta. It has a different tone. And it's kind of interesting that even though when we're doing the metta and the loving kindness, it does feel very blissful and we enjoy it very much. But at that time when it comes to an end, it's almost like it ends and there's actually the equanimity is almost like even more blissful. The equanimity is almost like it's even more peaceful. And we can see that, we can understand how this metta practice, as blissful as it may be, and as beautiful as it may be, and as necessary as it may be, it still is conditioned. And because it's conditioned, it's still not totally peaceful, totally blissful. There's something which is more peaceful than that. So it's very important to maintain this as part of your practice, to come to this sense of equanimity and be able to reflect back over your metta, look at the different stages of the metta practice and the different ways that the mind has changed throughout that practice. This is what will give rise to understanding, give rise to your vipassana. And through that we will learn the truth of what I've been saying, that metta, which is really useful and really necessary and really part of the path, that kind of metta is something which needs to be developed in a way that's very constant and very even, not in a way that's very kind of overpowering and gushy. It needs to become like when it talks about in the suttas, it talks about the 11 benefits of loving kindness. But of course the 11 benefits is not just for somebody who sort of says, oh, may all beings be happy, but it's someone who's developed the metta cetta vimutti, the heart's released by loving kindness, and has made it a vehicle, made it the basis, and has this whole list of synonyms, I can't remember all of them now, but made it well developed and fully developed and so on and so forth. And in other words, who's perfected it. So somebody who's perfected it in that way, and then those 11 benefits come. So if you haven't perfected it, then don't go complaining if you don't get the benefits. So we shouldn't be satisfied with a kind of a second rate or second best practice of metta or practice of loving kindness. We should have higher expectations for ourselves. We should aspire to be able to develop these things to the level of jhana. We should aspire to be able to not only get into jhana, but also to perfect it and develop it and maintain it. We should aspire to be able to develop an insight on the basis of that jhana, to be able to see these things as conditioned and see these things as nothing more than passing states of the mind. And we should aspire to be able to use this as a basis for penetrating to the Dhamma and seeing right through to the heart of things, being able to let go of the defilements at a very fundamental, basic level. This is what we should be aspiring to in our holy life. We should always be keeping these things in mind and keeping this big picture in mind. And then with our heart, it's like big, like the sky or like the ocean or like the earth. And then we're not going to be concerned about a bit of rubbish here and there. We're just going to drop it like the sky drops the rubbish that we throw into it, and keep the purity of our mind. Normally we do some guided meditation. I was just meaning to do, say, a few words as introduction to the meditation, but obviously it's turned into more than a few words. So maybe we can do the guided meditation now at the end of the talk rather than in the beginning. So let's finish off this time with some guided meditation for the next 20 minutes or half an hour or so. We sit together in this state of perfect silence and peace, allowing that silence that surrounds us to enter into our heart. Whenever thinking comes into the mind, we just note that thinking. The mind alert and watching, centered in the heart, catching even the smallest movement or vibration, and even the mind in the heart, bring up the words, may I be happy, may I be happy, may I be happy. Making the words even and soft, clear and steady. And to the loved person, may that loved person be happy. May that loved person be happy. May that loved person be happy. Keeping the words steady and even. Keeping the feeling of metta flowing, letting the feeling filling up the whole body, noticing any difference in the feeling of metta between the first stage and the second stage. Sometimes in the second stage it gets more intense, so we notice that. And to the neutral person, may that neutral person be happy, may they be happy, may they be happy. Keeping the words clear and steady in our mind, keeping the feeling flowing and steady and even. And to that disliked person, may that disliked person be happy, may they be happy, may they be happy. Keeping the mindfulness very sharp, mind very alert, taking that metta, spreading it out, may all people in this room be happy. May all people in this room be happy. May all people in this room be happy. And then bringing the feeling of metta back into the body. May that disliked person be happy. May they be happy. May they be happy. May the neutral person be happy. May they be happy. May they be happy. May the loved one be happy. May the loved one be happy, may the loved one be happy. May I be happy, may I be happy, may I be happy. Letting the words of metta go, letting the feeling of metta fade away, allowing the mind to return to a neutral space, empty, open and clear. Taking a minute to reflect over the meditation, inquiring into cause and effect. What just happened? Why did it happen? How did I use my mind? How did I apply the meditation? Where is the restlessness? Am I wanting to jump out of the meditation now? Where is that coming from? What defilements have been in my mind? What has been in my mind that protests against the Dhamma? Doesn't want to believe that the Dhamma is real? Where is that doubting? Where is that argumentativeness in my mind? Where is that thing that's stopping me from single-heartedly and solely pursuing that way of the Dhamma and the way of the meditation? If I can't find peace of mind, this is because of the five hindrances, not because of anything else. My mind was not peaceful. What are the hindrances that are stopping me from being peaceful? Finally, we can dedicate the merit of our practice. May all beings be happy. May all beings be well. May all beings rejoice in the merit that we've made through our practice. May all beings finally realize Nibbana. Does anyone have any comments or questions about tonight's talk?
Some of the verses there, only 3, 4, 5 lines, the language is so simple and clear, and there's no ill will or cruelty coming up in our lives. You know, we need to drive out of that.
Yeah.
And we do that, then it's just a bonus.
This was one of those interesting things where the book is treated as if it's kind of very basic, you know, basic Buddhism. But actually, when you look at it, it's very, very profound. You know, it's one of those things. It's where those profound teachings, they don't need a lot of words. It reminds me of like the teachings of someone like Ajahn Chah, and I think, you know, when you're reading Ajahn Chah's teachings, it's so easy to underestimate him because he teaches in a way that's so simple. It sounds like it's very basic, but actually, if you look at what he's saying, it's very, very profound dhammas, but he expresses it in very, you know, very homely ways. But some of those verses in the Dhammapada, like the one I like about the arahants whose tracks is hard to trace, like those of birds in the sky, and it's very beautiful. The commentary to that says that there was a dana, a house dana, and then one of the arahants arrived at the house dana, and that the person didn't know what road that he'd used to walk to the house dana on, and said, "Oh yes, the ways of arahants are hard to track. It's like those of birds in the sky." It's kind of doesn't quite bring out the full profundity of the image, perhaps. Yeah, maybe. Okay, that's good. So the first, that's two nice easy questions there from Linda Lucy. One is how do you know to make the right choices? And the other one is, what are the five hindrances and how do you deal with them? Well, we've got a few days, we might be able to work our way through them, but very briefly, how do you know the right choices? You know the right choices, you don't know what's the right choice to start, okay? Because choice is like that. Choice is, you know, walking along the road and you reach a fork in the road and you know that one of those goes to where you want and one of them doesn't. And you have to choose, but you don't know until you actually get there. And by the time you've got there, then you can't un-get there. You can walk the way, you can walk back the road and trace your steps back, but of course you're not back in the original place that you were before because you changed. Now you know where those two roads go, and you don't, before you didn't, so it's different. You can't get back to the same place. So the simple answer is that you never know when you're making a choice. You never know whether it's actually going to be the right one. That's impossible to know that because it's better would be predicting the future. Choices that we make are things that influence the future. And you simply never do know what's going to be the future outcome of them. So this is why a lot of people have a lot of problems with doubting and things, because they want to be able to predict everything in the future before they make a choice. And of course you have to realize it's just impossible. So you can't predict things, but what you can do is you can try to use your common sense, try to use your intelligence, your experience, and use the standard of the Dhamma as best you can. And so that's one of the reasons why it's important to study the Dhamma in detail, because, you know, we can all accept the principles of Dhamma fairly easily. That's usually not a problem. But, you know, when it comes down, how do we know to apply that in a particular instance? Then that's where we need guidance. So if we look into the suttas and the Vinaya, then we see a wealth of precedent. And it's one of the things about the Vinaya. The Vinaya is not a literature which is kind of immediately or obviously a kind of inspiring or spiritual in some ways. But what is quite inspiring about it is just the even-handedness of the Buddha when he deals with so many different circumstances. And always, whenever there's a problem, and the Buddha never overreacts or does anything which is kind of extreme or violent or anything. And it's just always so peaceful and so calm, and just takes a basis of equanimity and a basis of truth. And so it's, you know, always if there's an accusation or a criticism, he invites the person before him and say, is this true? Did this happen? And they say it's true or it's not true. And if it's true, then he'll admonish them if it's wrong. And if it's not true, then he'll excuse them. And it's very, this kind of principle is very, it's very simple, but not easy to do. And the kind of the beautiful or inspiring thing about the Vinaya is the way that the Buddha just does this so persistently, even when people make absolutely outrageous accusations, you know, accusing arahants of all kinds of awful things, and then he'll still follow exactly the same procedure. Call them up, okay, this is true, and follow through the same thing. So that's quite beautiful precedent. So that's one of the ways that we can inform our choices, is through educating ourselves in wise precedents. Yeah, and that's not going to solve all our problems, because of course we're never in exactly the same situations that the Buddha was. But still, we can have more wisdom about it and then a bit more knowledge about it. So that's one way that that can help. Another way that's sometimes useful is to objectify things a little bit. For example, we could even ask ourselves, well, what would the Buddha do in this situation? What choice would the Buddha make? And, you know, sometimes then it becomes very obvious. Not always, but sometimes it'll become very obvious. Well, the Buddha would have reacted in this way, he wouldn't have reacted in that way. And so sometimes that might be able to help. And sometimes another way that you can do it is, there are various ways of dealing with problem solving and decision making. One way is to, you can do it consciously if you like, by like making lists of pros and cons and weighing them up. That's a very kind of rational way of doing it. A more or less rational way of doing it would be to meditate, and at a time when your meditation is very pure and very deep, and then come out of your meditation, and then at that time just ask yourself what's the right thing to do when your mind is as pure as you can, and just say what's the right thing in the bottom of my heart that I feel is the right thing to do, and then that sometimes will help. You can see the truth, although it's not always true. The results, none of these methods are going to give you know, the truth in the right way all the time. So this is where you have to have a certain humility about it, and to realize that even though I don't know it, but still life goes on and I have to make a choice, one or the other. So I don't know if that's at all helpful in answering that question of how to make the right choice. But in another practical thing before I leave that, in knowing how to make the right choice, is that also that you have to know when to make a choice and when to make a decision, and to neither be too quick or too slow with that. So you don't, you know, if you know that you need more information, then sometimes you just need to get more information, and then you can overcome that doubt. But of course, sometimes that information isn't to hand, or you can't do it, so you can't delay things indefinitely. But in certain circumstances, you know, you can't make a proper, an informed decision until you've actually got the information. And it's interesting in the suttas, the opposite of doubt, we would think that the opposite of doubt is faith, but sometimes it says that the opposite of doubt is investigation or inquiry. And that's very interesting, because often we find that investigation and inquiry gives rise to doubt. That's what they say, especially in the theological seminaries. They say the more you do theology, the more you doubt about God. But in Buddhism, it's the other way around, because sometimes we doubt because we don't know enough. And when we investigate, inquire, then that will get rid of our doubts. So that's another way it's very important. So then the second question, what are the five hindrances? Sensual desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and remorse, and doubt. So these are the five. And how do you get rid of them? Well, sensual desire you get rid of by seeing the asubha nimitta. That means you see that aspect of things which is ugly or unbeautiful or repulsive. So, for example, if you see a person's face and you think, oh, they're so beautiful, and you fall in love with them, then Ajahn Brahm's advice is to look at the pimple. So there's always something, like even if you know you find the top model in the world or something like that, they've always got some pimples and things, and they're never presentable until they've been airbrushed and so on, and got their makeup and all of these kinds of things. The amount of time and effort that they have to maintain, they keep to maintain that image. So when that's a very, very powerful technique, because the perception of beauty and the perception of attractiveness only happens purely because we see this subhanimitta. And if we're not seeing that subhanimitta, that sign or that aspect of things that is beautiful, then that lust or desire can't arise. So all we have to do is see the asubhanimitta. And it doesn't have to be necessarily to a very deep level. Of course, it's best if it is. But even at a simple level, simply to having a thought of non-beauty is enough that we don't at that moment have a thought of beauty. And so that's how we overcome desire. Ill will, overcoming ill will. I've been talking about that in the talk already, so I'm not going to talk about that anymore. But they're a pair, so sensual desire and ill will. Sensual desire is arisen by the subhanimitta. Ill will arisen by the patighanimitta. And they're a pair, so we can't really overcome one without the other. I mean, contingently or pragmatically we can to a certain degree, but ultimately they're a pair and they have to be overcome together. So, and then sloth and torpor, then we overcome sloth and torpor by putting forth effort. And that's really the only way if we've got problems with like sleepiness and all of these kinds of things and laziness, the only way really to overcome it is just by trying. So you have to keep on trying, and people think, oh, well, I was meditating, but I was sleepy, so I couldn't meditate or whatever. But, you know, it's solely in the trying to overcome these things. This is where you develop the energy. So you just have to keep on trying. And that's actually like developing that energy is one of the hardest things in the Buddhist path, because you just need persistence. And there's no guarantee that that's going to happen easily and pleasantly. And the Buddha didn't say that everyone's path was pleasant. Some people have the pleasant way of practice, and other people have a painful way of practice. So as long as it's a way of practice, we don't really care, actually. You can come to me and complain, oh, it's so much suffering and blah, 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 and practice is blah, 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 and there's so much pain. Well, I don't really care, actually. As long as you're practicing, it doesn't really matter. The only problem with the fact that it's suffering, the only problem with that is that it tends to discourage people and stop them from practicing. So in that way, it's a problem, but the fact that it's actually suffering is not a particularly big deal. You just have to keep going, and so that's where you need a lot of perseverance. And so that's really what that energy is just a perseverance to be able to just keep going to overcome stuff. And restlessness and remorse. Restlessness, lack of tranquility in the mind and body is overcome through the samatha nimitta, that sign of things of the samatha. So it's overcome through watching the breath and watching the peaceful aspect of things. And remorse is like worry about things that have happened in the past, especially breaking of sila or anything we've done in the past causes worry. For example, if we've been negligent in our practice or something like that, and we feel we have a sense of remorse or regret about that, or we feel that, you know, maybe someone's died, someone who's close to us has died, and we feel upset because of something that we did or said, or that we should have said something to them before they died or something like that. So we feel a sense of remorse. So this is also one of the hindrances. And so this is something that needs to be overcome. So the way to overcome remorse, firstly, is through just being very careful in our sila and being very careful in how we do things, so we don't give rise to any future remorse. And also just reflecting on these things, those things that happened in the past are done with. Like the word for remorse is kukucha, which literally is kukritya in Sanskrit, is bad doneness. And because it's done, it's a past participle form, and it refers to things in the past. So the things that we have remorse about are things that are actually already in the past. So the way to overcome this is to also reflect, well, that's happened in the past. And that doesn't mean it's not true, but it just means it's not here anymore, it's not relevant anymore. So we just let it go, let it be in the past. And presence of remorse, and the last one, doubt. And again, I've talked about that a little bit already, is that doubt is, and we give rise to through, you know, looking at things in the wrong way and so on and so forth. So, you know, to overcome doubt, firstly, by doing devotional practices of recollection of the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha, is a very beautiful way to overcome doubt, because it's like these are the things which are like really true and very and really good, things that are really worthy of the highest respect and homage. And so we can have that full confidence in paying respects to the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha, that this is something that is really beautiful, so that gives rise to that mind of faith. So this is something we should be practicing every day, doing some faith practices, bowing, doing some chanting and so on, to give rise to this mind of faith. And also by inquiry. But not like by a kind of a restless inquiry that's just interested in knowledge for the sake of knowledge, but the kind of inquiry which is able to recognize a state of confusion. So when you recognize that there's a confusion or a not knowingness, then you need to exercise your inquiry in that area until you actually clear that up, until you know what is the case, and it's something which we can actually do. It's not beyond any of us to see, okay, there's a certain doubt in a certain matter. We recognize that, and then we inquire. Sometimes it might need to ask somebody who knows about it, sometimes to research in the books and see what the books say, or sometimes it might need like inquiry within our own mind, like an inner inquiry as well. Like, you know, we have a doubt about our own motivation, for example, and then we need to inquire about that. Was my motivation pure or not? And we sort of inquire about it to really look into what the reasons were for acting in that way, in that circumstance. And so these things will help to overcome that doubt. So these are the five hindrances: sensual desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and remorse, and doubt. Is that okay? Okay. All right, let's finish by paying respect.
Patipanno bhagavato savaka